from London, BBC Caribbean Report.
Cuban exiles in Florida threaten to shut down Miami if Elian Gonzalez is returned home. More questions than answers into the inquiry into the suicide of a Bahamian prisoners. And CARICOM and Canada thrash out trade issues in Trinidad. I'm Orin Gordon, and this is BBC Caribbean Report.
On Monday, we're calling for everyone to drive with their vehicles throughout the whole day through the Miami International Airport in order to slow down the airport and even bring it to a halt if necessary.
Ramon Saul Sanchez of the Miami Democracy Movement. Anti-Castro Cuban exile groups are calling for the shutdown of Miami Airport on Monday in an attempt to block the return of six-year-old Elian Gonzalez to Cuba. It was the second day of demonstrations today over an immigration service decision to return Elian to Cuba. For the latest, here's Malcolm Brabant in Miami.
If the hardliners carry out their threat to blockade the airport, it could cause massive disruption, as it's the gateway to South America and one of the busiest hubs in the Western Hemisphere. The anti-Castro exiles have been protesting for more than 48 hours now, and there have been several confrontations with police in riot gear. Police fired tear gas at one angry crowd. So far, more than 135 people have been arrested during demonstrations that succeeded in holding up traffic at key intersections. Florida's governor, Jeb Bush, asked President Clinton to overrule the Immigration Service, which decided that Elian should be returned to his father in Cuba. But Mr. Clinton is standing firm.
I believe that they follow the law and the procedures. This is a volatile and difficult case, and those who want to challenge it will have to follow the law and the procedures. I think that's the only way to do this. We need to keep this out of the political process as much as possible.
Lawyers for the relatives who've been caring for Elian are expected to go to court soon to lodge an appeal. They claim that the Immigration Service has broken its own rules by deciding to send Elian back without a proper hearing.
Malcolm Brabant reporting. In the Bahamas, an embarrassing inquiry into the suicide of a death row prisoner is continuing. John Higgs was found dead on Wednesday morning, the eve of his execution. The authorities went ahead with the execution of his fellow death row inmate David Mitchell early Thursday. Meanwhile, in Bermuda, the government has been receiving the plaudits of human rights organizations for abolishing the death penalty. He'll be going to Hamilton in a short while, but first to Debbie Nash in Nassau to hear how the Bahamian prison authorities have fared during the Higgs inquest.
Day two of the coroner's inquest into the alleged suicide Tuesday evening of condemned inmate John Higgs is beginning to show signs of a frayed penal system, perhaps stretching as far as the Central Intelligence Division of the Bahamas Police Force. After some 7 hours now of questions to a number of witnesses, there are still no answers forthcoming about either the object with which the condemned man slit his right wrist, or where and how the said object was disposed, or by whom. Another interesting fact, John Higgs was right-handed. In yesterday's testimony, the forensic pathologist had testified that the suicide was committed by one cut alone, in his words, resembling that made by either a razor blade or a scalpel. What was found in the cell were two notes written by John Higgs, with varying messages similar to the one he had sent to a local radio host, and whose contents were published in the local papers only yesterday. On one of those notes produced this morning was written, "Thank you for the assistant of the 10 p.m. shift. No name, no blame." A very uncomfortable police sergeant, who was among the first to arrive at the prison after Higgs' death, was asked about the death instrument and acknowledged it was possible Higgs could have gotten some outside help. When pressed to explain what was meant by outside help, he replied that, quote, "he probably could have gotten some help from elsewhere, such as fellow inmates, visitors, prison officers," end quote. And just before the afternoon recess, more questions were posed to this prison superintendent about how Mr. Higgs could have been able to write those last letters. He explained that an inmate needed to request a pen, since a condemned man's cell is stripped of almost everything. It was the assistant superintendent himself who would give permission for a pen to be given to the prisoner and then returned. He says he received no such request from John Higgs. There are far more questions being raised than answers given as this coroner's inquest into the late John Higgs continues. And what was thought first to be a speedy open and shut inquiry is now scheduled to stretch into at least the middle of next week. Debbie Nash in Nassau, Bahamas for BBC Caribbean Report.
And I'm Vicki Abraham in Hamilton, Bermuda, where the island has taken steps to abolish the death penalty. Amnesty International is applauding Bermuda's stance. The local Amnesty chapter, which holds a strong presence in Bermuda, played a key role in trying to educate the public on the human rights issues surrounding the death penalty. For many years, Bermudians have opposed removing capital punishment from the books, considering it a deterrent to the most heinous of crimes. On the other hand, those few who were convicted of premeditated murder in the past 22 years have always had the pardon of the governor from the mandatory death penalty. Judicial corporal punishment is also wiped from Bermuda's slate of laws, another punishment not used locally for decades. Despite resistance in recent years, the people of Bermuda appear to have accepted there was no real choice in the matter. A March 1999 UK white paper implicitly outlined that all dependent territories will be rid of the death penalty, judicial corporal punishment, and any ban on homosexuality, one way or the other. Bermuda's recent move will not put the pressure on the Caribbean UK territories. It's Britain herself stating the rules. In many cases where the local House of Assembly doesn't change the territory's laws, Britain can legislate through the Privy Council, an order in council for the public good. So as one official here has put it, the other overseas territories can huff and puff resisting the changes, or they can take the easy way and change the laws themselves. Either way, it will be done. For BBC Caribbean Report, I'm Vicki Abraham.
The outgoing head of the IMF, Michel Camdesou, says the organization should be given greater political clout and more precise responsibilities. He's criticized the rich countries for not giving enough aid, and he thinks the fight against poverty should be more of a priority. Do Mr. Camdesou's comments suggest that the IMF is a body in need of drastic reform? Well, that's a question I put to Wilburn Prasad, a lecturer in economics at the University of the West Indies at Mona.
The IMF is in need of major overhaul, and it has been in need of such overhaul for a very, very, very long period. Camdesou is recognizing that the International Monetary Fund needs to be reformed. The issue is he suggesting reform in the right direction and at the right pace and at the right level? The G7 should be broadened, and the effective executive power of those groupings within the IMF should be increased. But I believe there needs to be some mechanism which allows a say of the poor of this world.
Some of those poor countries will argue that the IMF has too much power as things stand.
Exactly. The best way to understand the IMF is to consider the IMF as the institution which takes over from the colonial office. You had the colonial office, and the British government, through that office, handed out grant in aid and determined what a country could do. Now, this is what the IMF does. The IMF is involved with a country when it's on its knees, and it dictates what's to be done. My point is, if the IMF is to get more power, then that power has to be exercised based on some consultative arrangement, and not the so-called Washington Consensus, which says these are the rules of the game, and these are the rules. They're not going to be bent regardless of your condition.
From their point of view, they are introducing to countries that don't have a culture of it fiscal stringency and fiscal responsibility. What's wrong with that?
There's nothing wrong with fiscal stringency and fiscal responsibility. Indeed, many of the things which the IMF suggests should be done by a country ought to be done by that country. Usually what happens with the IMF is that they come with some rigid rules. They come with a book and they fill in the blanks. What's the rate of growth of output? What's the GDP, etc., etc.? And they press a button and the answers come out. But that's not the way it can be done. There are social forces and realities, and there are cultural elements which will impede or assist that process in working. When was Mr. Sandiford Prime Minister Barbados? I don't recall, but they had problems. He decided not to go to the IMF. And out of that came a social consensus, something which Jamaica has been struggling to achieve for many years. And they were able to survive and to ride out their problems without going to the IMF. Had they gone to the IMF, Barbados would have been in deep, deep, deep trouble.
Economist Wilburn Prasad. In Trinidad, CARICOM foreign ministers have been meeting with their Canadian counterpart, Lloyd Axworthy. He told them that Canada favors giving CARICOM the preferences it requires for membership of the Free Trade Area of the Americas and other bodies. Our reporter, Tony Fraser, caught up with the chairman of the meeting, the St. Kitts and Nevis Prime Minister, Denzel Douglas.
We have also had a commitment from Canada to advance the repositioning and the reorientation of our various economies, our small economies here in the Caribbean region, especially as we are now troubled with the challenges from globalization and trade liberalization. Information technology, the advancement of that is one of the areas that Canada again has committed and is in fact investing financially in the advancement and the reformation and reform in a number of our education, in the education system in a number of our countries, so as to ensure that our people are better repositioned to meet the challenges of globalization.
Any particular commitment from the Canadian Prime Minister with regard to this matter of globalization and special considerations for small states like CARICOM in that whole process?
Yes, I think Canada understands that the whole question of small states would require special and preferential treatment. That is acceptable to Canada. In fact, I can say to you that the problems that we've had with the OECD countries, we've brought that to the attention of the Canadian government, and they have been very supportive of our position. Canada has also understood this special call by the OECS territories to become a member of the IDB. That too is fully supported by Canada.
Denzel Douglas on the move, but still talking to Tony Fraser. Still at the Trinidad meeting, the Guyana government has received an apology from the Canadian Foreign Minister, Lloyd Axworthy, over the way in which Canada deported seven Guyanese nationals. One of Foreign Minister Clement Rohe's main tasks in Port of Spain was to make a strong complaint to the Canadian Foreign Minister. The deportees were put on two private planes and flown to Guyana without the Guyanese authorities being notified. According to Guyana's Foreign Ministry, the Canadian High Commissioner in Georgetown poured more fuel on the fire by saying that Canadian immigration would do it again. This was Lloyd Axworthy in Port of Spain earlier today.
One of the measures that was taken recently in Guyana, I must say I regret. I think that the way it was handled was not proper, and that I'll be meeting with the Guyana ministers to assure them that we won't be pursuing that particular methodology any further. At the same time, I think it's very important that we have a discussion with the CARICOM minister about how we can work out this deportation issue to the mutual satisfaction of both. I know it's not easy sometimes to accept these people back in the countries, but under our rules, if they've committed a crime, they have to be deported. That's the law, and it's a law that conforms with international conventions as well.
Lloyd Axworthy. And in Guyana, controversy is brewing over the blocking of calls from the United States from midnight on New Year's Eve. Thousands of callers from the U.S. found it impossible to call anyone in Guyana by using the giant American carrier AT&T. Guyana Telephone and Telegraph Company and AT&T are blaming each other for the blocking of the service. Colin Smith reports from Georgetown.
A statement from the Guyana Telephone and Telegraph Company says since the start of the year, AT&T has not been allowing calls into Guyana because the local company refused to lower its international rates. The GT&T says lowering these rates would have resulted in substantial increases in local telephone bills. The company, which has the monopoly in the telephone industry in Guyana, did not say by how much its own income would be lowered if the new rate was introduced. The local phone company also said that its decision to refuse to lower its rate is consistent with the advice given by the region's umbrella body for telephone companies, the Caribbean Association of National Telecommunications Organizations, CANTO. However, in a statement today in a local newspaper, AT&T's public relations says it was the GT&T who began blocking calls from the USA. The US telecommunications giant said, with improved technology, there is a worldwide trend to bring down rates to reflect the true costs. The AT&T statement said, while that company routinely negotiates rate agreements with its carriers worldwide, the rates with Guyana has remained unchanged for the past 13 years. There has been no further comment from the local company since the release from AT&T. However, observers feel that the block could have been effected in the absence of a new negotiated agreement or because the U.S. carrier unilaterally began using a new rate. Colin Smith in Georgetown, Guyana for BBC Caribbean Report.
And that is it for BBC Caribbean Report. Before we go, here's a reminder.
This and our other programs can be accessed on our internet website at www.bbc.co.uk/Caribbean.
Our next programs are Monday morning at 11:05, 11:15 and 12:10 GMT. This is Orin Gordon saying goodbye.